if we isolate our own experience of what we've seen as good management and bad management, we'll probably cover the most essential points. So before, rather than me speak, I thought, why don't we, or what you know, either what you've seen, what you've read, what you've experienced, what you've learned. So if you ask me to share, that'll take up 3 hours.
Okay.
I'll ask you. In other words, what works and what doesn't. And although this is a course on leadership, I think there's a gray area between leadership and management, so I don't want to restrict you in what you describe. You may describe bad management. Or bad management.
Okay. The last two places I worked at, the first place, they created a culture of responsibility. And the second, they let the culture be created by the employees. So it ended up being a culture of people talking bad about each other.
So could you explain how they created the culture of what you said, the culture of respect?
Respect.
A responsibility. How did they create that culture?
They had, for instance, a monthly program called Silverstones, where for a monthly meeting of the entire company, which was over 100 people, they got together and they presented, it was a stone that had the company a logo carved out on it, and they would present each month. Two people would present that to someone else that they respected, they admired, they thought did a great job, and they would explain why. And then the company also gave that person $100. And so they were creating this culture where people were more focused on, you know, how they're going to appreciate someone rather than how they're going to complain about someone.
So how did that trickle down into the daily lives of the employees being appreciative from that?
Well, sometimes it did and sometimes it didn't, but it created more of a culture of that. And it trickled down in the sense that you know, if you have the stone, you're thinking, well, who am I going to give it to next month? You know, who do I really like, admire, appreciate their work and their efforts? If you don't have the stone, you're thinking, boy, it would be nice to, you know, get that stone someday. So what do I do in order to get the stone someday?
Mm-hmm.
And get that kind of appreciation.
Okay, So the first point you made is very important. You were saying, if you don't create culture, the culture becomes basically the bad qualities of the people, or whatever the qualities are, which tend to be at least, 70% negative?
I can't comment on that.
And that's what I was told. By a corporate consultant. That was his analysis.
70%
negative. Average person. Mm-hmm. But the point you're making is that you have to consciously create culture, or culture will evolve. Whatever way it evolves, based on the nature of the people, which generally and often evolves into criticism and lack of respect, more or less. So, should we write this down? Should I take notes or something? Just as something I could send you or someone?
I can type it into my.
I can put it in. Like, as long as it's working today.
Okay. and read something. I put it in these terms. You create culture, or culture creates you.
Yes.
That's the way I experience it. And my experience within ISKCON, because I go to so many places, is that every place has culture. And where the culture is not thought out, that's the place people complain the most. Because they're looking at the culture and it doesn't reflect Christian consciousness. And they're saying, why are we doing this? And why can't we change this? So that means we have a culture, but we haven't put it in place. And the culture that's predominating is usually the conditioned nature of the devotees, which is reflecting that local culture. So when you go to India, it's one way. You go to South America, it's one way. ISKCON is not the same because it's reflecting the culture. In the ideal world, it would be more or less the same because culture would be created. And this is the way it is everywhere. As we know, that's how a franchise works. And the other point he's making is that they actually consciously created the culture. They did something to create it. So I can give an example of this in ISKCON, if you like. From what I've seen, I spent a lot of time in Chaupati, going in and out of Mumbai, and then being invited to do programs. So both, I've done, I don't know, 4 or 5 programs between an eco-village in Mumbai, and then just being there. We took the tour there, 2 tours. So I've been there probably 10 times. So I'm a very observant person. I look at things, and this is the way I am. I analyze them. So what I saw in that temple was they created a culture consciously. Everything was thought out. It wasn't haphazard. You had Brahmacharya Ashram. It was clear what the ashram was. Everybody knew the rules, everybody knew what it meant to be a brahmacharya. There was culture. It wasn't like you become a brahmacharya and you just kind of do whatever. It was defined. You knew when you came in, this is the culture of a brahmacharya, this is what it means, this is how you live. These are the parameters. There was a culture created of respect, of service. It was very clear, you could see it. It was very thick. And so when I saw it, and I saw the universal nature of it, then I understood that they had consciously created it. And then we went to Govardhan Eco Village. And have any of you been to the Eco Village? Just for a moment.
This is Bombay? This is Bombay?
When you go to the Eco Village, if you have... Okay, this is... It's not just the Eco Village, but everywhere. The one thing that I noticed, that in everything they were doing, it was well thought out. In the whole Chaupati Eco Village. What do they call that? Meals? Daily meals? What's the name?
Akshaya Patra in Bangalore, otherwise in Bombay, it's called Hare Krishna food for that.
This one was called another one. Because this was a Chaupati, had a different name.
It's something meal.
Midday meals. It's called midday meals. But anyway, so we got to go to the midday meals, and I spent a lot of time in the temple, and I've been to Eco Village, I think, 4 times now. And to my perception, nothing was done haphazardly. Like things were thought out in detail, practically and culturally. That's what I noticed. And I saw the introduction of the iPhone 6 when it was presented. You know how we see those presentations when they release a new product? So they explain what they've done. And they explain the evolution of the iPhone and what they're doing. And when you listen to the explanation, you realize these guys are really thinking well about everything they're doing, everything they're programming. It's very clear. And after I saw it, I went into a state of depression for half an hour. And I said, I want to work for Apple, because ISKCON is so spaced out. They don't think like that.
I want to be part of an organization, but think some detail. You know, it's like when you go to a temple, and you if you go to a temple and you never have to ask the question, why are they doing this? That means everything's been thought out. Otherwise, you see things that don't make sense, and you say, why are they doing that? Why, isn't it? You have that experience? You question, you know, why is this going on? So my experience with Chapati was a little bit like that, that they were, everything was well thought out. It wasn't like, why are you doing this? I don't know, nobody knows. This doesn't work. Why did you correct it? I don't know. No, I don't know. And you can't talk to the person in charge, you all listen to us. None of that. Yeah. But that tends to be more typical in other places. So I saw they were creating culture. When you go to the eco-village, it's so well thought out. It's just, how should we say? It's like their eco-village is like the iPhone. Every department is well thought out. Why they do it? You ask them, why are you doing this? You'll get a detailed answer. You'll get a dissertation on why we're doing this. It's really nice. So, yes.
Yeah, I've heard most businesses, a lot of the employees understand the what they're doing, but they don't understand the why.
Yeah. So the why, okay, so now I'll bring up another point. But this is a really big point. Well, you understand the idea of culture? You have a culture. Every temple has a culture, whatever it is. People attend the morning program, they don't. People come to class, they don't. People fight, they don't. People serve, you know. Every temple has a culture. And some temples, you know, you go to a temple, it's all Brahmacharis. It's a certain culture. It can create itself. It's, you know, the early days of ISKCON, it's all Brahmacharis. We didn't try to create culture. It was just, it created itself. But it was a good culture. But there's going to be a culture there. And some temples are more conscious of creating the culture. Some temples are not conscious. And Abhavabhadra is saying is that if you're conscious of creating the culture, one of the ways you do it is everybody knows what it is. And everybody buys into it, everyone agrees on it, and everyone's inspired by it. And so if you ask them, why do you exist? You can say, and you're all saying the same thing because you're all on the same page, because you all together developed a culture. Right? There's a guy named Simon, what's his name? Does anybody know him? He's from New York. He's a fairly well-known author and speaker. Simon something. If you go on YouTube, you'll see a lecture by him. It's about a 20-minute talk, and he said, it's not what you do, it's why you do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. Why do you exist? He said, people don't buy Apple computers because of what they do. They buy Apple computers because of the company. Why the company exists. He said, in their ads, they don't advertise computers. They advertise that we think different. And people, that's what the people are buying. So then you can look it up. But that's the main theme of his talk. It's not what you do, it's why you do it. So the why is the culture. The why is the mission. And what's common in companies is that you have a why that nobody is inspired by. Or you have a why that nobody knows. And they've been told, but if you ask them what it is, they can't tell you, even though it's on the wall, because they're not inspired by it. So that's where you lose, because you have people working for you, but they don't have... They're working for you, but they're not working...
Well, there's a
word in this one, I can't. People can work for you, or they can work, maybe it's with you. The concept is, you have an employee, they're working for the company. They don't identify the company with their values, their interests, so there's not a feeling of, this is my company. Right? So when we started ISKCON, Prabhupada created this, like, we felt ISKCON was ours, so we worked at it as if it were our own family, our own business. We identified with it. So that's what mission does. I was listening to a lecture by the CEO of Procter. What's that company in India? It's one of the big companies in India.
Infosys?
not a computer company, a product company.
Tata?
Cosmetics, soaps.
Red wine.
Hindustan Lever.
Yeah. Hindustan Lever. And he was saying they have the least number of people leaving their company because they attract people to their principles. I don't know what their principles are. If somebody likes what the company stands for and they work for it, they don't leave. Right? But if they don't believe in it, there's no inspiration. So he said. So that's a real key. And it was kind of easy for Prabhupada to do that because everyone who joined was buying into a why. Right? This kind is a why. But then if you get deviated, then you'll come to a temple and you say, why does it exist? And you won't feel that why anymore. The why the Prabhupada created was revolution, change the world. Go out on the street and ask 100 people, would you like to make the world better? You'd probably get 30, 40, 50, 60, 70%, 80% say yeah. That's how Prabhupada attracted. Would you like to create a revolution in the way people think? Yeah, that's pretty exciting, isn't it? Just let's say, hypothetically, our mission, our vision was to create a revolution in the way people think, because Prabhupada said that in Bhagavatam. You know that? You know that? A revolution. It's a revolution in thinking, a revolution in consciousness.
Yeah.
What's your mission? Create a revolution in consciousness. Wow, that's pretty exciting. It has to be something that's exciting. Yeah. That was very exciting to hippies. It's changed the world, right? So everybody bought into that. And everybody knew. We all knew what we were doing. So we weren't working for ISKCON. We were working in ISKCON, with ISKCON. So you understand the aspect of the why of Balabhadra saying. It's not the what. What we were doing was distributing books, distributing prasadam, doing Harinam. That's the what. That was not as motivating as the why. Why are you out on the street chanting? Because this chanting is changing the consciousness of every person that goes by. There's a company called Avatar who teaches workshops, and their motto or their tagline is creating an enlightened planetary system. Enlightened EPC, enlightened planetary community. That's their goal. Essentially. Through their teachings, they'll enlighten the world, right? Those people are so fired up because they believe through the teachings of Avatar they'll change the course of history. That's what they believe. And they're way more fired up than your average ISKCON temple. It's like, because they have that mission. And there's no question of everybody not knowing it and working for it. Everybody's. So it's exactly what Prabhupada did. This movement will change the world. Now when you get to the point you say, oh, this movement's finished, it's not going to do anything, then you lose it. Right? Or you're not manifesting your vision in action, and everybody loses their enthusiasm. Right? So, I don't know what your vision is or your mission is here, but there has to be a vision and a mission that everyone buys into, that motivates everything. Do you have one?
Yeah, we just created about a month, probably 2 months ago.
What is it?
To expand Krishna consciousness globally and locally. That's the vision.
Expand Krishna consciousness?
Locally and globally.
Locally and globally. Doesn't inspire me. You have to reword it.
But that's what...
Yeah, it's got to be something that's got emotion.
That's our reason. And we shall have the peace.
Expanded is too general. I just read one yesterday. Let's see if I have it.
I'll have to reevaluate it.
Yeah.
It has to be something. When people hear, they get excited. They want to be part of that. It's got to be.
it's got to be something that everyone in the temple is.
Well, the ISKCON for Western Canada is the mission statement is the same as the first principle of Srila Prabhupada's Buddha, so they've just adopted that same mission statement. So mission statement. The temple council created their own mission and mission elements. Just this.
Every department can have their mission and vision. The mission and vision are different.
Yeah. But that's our reason though. Expand Krishna globally and locally. Mission, there are three statements of mission, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm not excited.
I'm not excited. It's got to be something that everyone.
Well, there's the temple council one. That's just what the hell the temple council is.
Yeah, that's more of a managerial.
And then there's the whole Srila Prabhupada's. Actually, could you Google Srila Prabhupada's to 7 minutes book?
You don't have enough minutes on your cell phone.
I don't have it on my cell phone.
I might have something for you that I could read.
I think we have a key statement of mission. To continue chanting, devotion, all those things.
Yes.
And to be financially and responsible. I think that's the second one. There's one more. The key statements.
Yes.
First one is just not taking over that differently. Deity worship, Harinam, the distribution festivals, and empower everyone, to empower everyone to be Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
That's the
we're just talking about
I want to read something to you from a company called Zappos.com.
What's the name?
Zappos.com. Everybody sent it to me last night. I have to see if I can find the video. Does it list their mission? Does this give you an idea? It's a pretty cutting edge company. Zappos.com. Zappos are, I think it's a shoe. They sell shoes online.
Have you heard
that? Zappos.com. Oh, this is a very slow connection.
What?
Mission statement is, you see, the mission. Well, you can have a mission and then a vision. The vision statement is creates the culture. So if you say to expand Krishna consciousness, it doesn't create a culture so much. But if you say to take responsibility for anything, you take responsibility for every problem, that creates a culture.
Everyone feeling comfortable with the wording and things like that as well. We didn't run it through a
what I would say, test. I would say, then look at that and say, does that create a culture?
Krishna consciousness is a culture, that's why we took it.
No, but practically, within the organization, would that create the kind of, define the culture you'd want.
Krishna consciousness is a culture, and that culture is basically
specifically define it.
You're not defining the reason. Because
the kind of culture I'm talking about, interaction, that kind of culture. Not Krishna consciousness is a culture, that's just very general, but specifically.
And it's where the missionary support says to Harinam, book distribution, deity worship, festivals. That's the second, that's this mission. The other one is to empower everybody to be Krishna consciousness. Third is to have ISKCON financially responsible. I don't say financially responsible or something.
Yeah.
So the three statements.
That's about
good memory.
It's on our bulletin board. I have festival and wedding rings still, so I don't know.
To me, those are all practical things, but I don't see.
I think you must have your minutes or something. I'm just going by memory.
That's really good.
The vision is, I know, vision is 100% right. Three statements are not in the same sequence.
Yeah.
First sequence is like that. Deity worship, book distribution, Harinam, festivals, things like that. And third one is to be financially responsible, and second one is to empower everybody. That's the other one.
What kind of culture do you want in the temple? That may be a better way of adjusting it.
That's
loving and caring culture.
Yeah, so that, how are you going to create that in a... That has to be... In other words, if you say, why does this temple exist in one sentence? What are you trying to do? That's inspiring. It would be inspiring that everyone would... That would inspire people, a guy on the street. I'll give you an example. This guy said, when someone asks you what you do, don't tell them what you do. Tell them the effect of what you do. Like if you're a teacher, you say, what do? I change the future. That's what I'm doing. I'm creating a new future. Wow, how do you do that? Oh, I teach. If you told them I'm a teacher, that's not exciting. You see what I'm saying? So like, what do you do? What are you doing? He said, why do you exist? So I was giving the example, we exist to create a revolution in consciousness. That may not be how you want to say it, but it's an idea.
I think people were wanting to stick with the words Krishna consciousness and have that integrity of language that Srila Prabhupada had brought forward. And so I think that was part of it too, was not wanting to step away from common language.
Yeah. That's more common with devotees.
Yes.
Oh, we have a mission statement for Kirtan Vancouver we created a while back. I think I don't know if this is the one we did with you or before you. Should I read it?
Yeah, I read it.
Would love to get some. Kirtan Vancouver is a non-profit organization with the goal of bringing the community together through yoga, music, and art. By tapping into the world's most ancient sound vibrations and showcasing them in a modern environment. Creating an oasis in the city, we aim to channel the energy of today's youth into a transformative event. Kirtan is a means for promoting peace through music. Then it ends with, funds raised will support local community programs. We can make a difference.
Sorry. This whole thing that we never said for the whole long thing?
I think so.
Can I just read the...
I think it's part of Vision of Zappos.
The Vision of Zappos?
Yeah.
To give you an idea. I've got to find it here.
Is that window open?
That door is open.
Maybe that's where we get the noise.
I mean, you have to understand this is a business, so the word, it's an alternative. It's probably a bunch of young people. It's not like traditional. Deliver wow through service.
Pardon me?
Deliver wow. You know what that means?
Yeah, it's excitement.
That means people, when they deal with the company, they won't say, that was good service or nice service. Also, they'll say, wow. Deliver wow. Embrace and drive change. In other words, when change happens, they say there's resistance, so that you go with it. Everybody takes it in a positive way. Whoa. How did I just miss that? Create fun and a little weirdness.
Why is that?
So that people like working there, and people, it's fun, and they'll do. I mean, we may not want to do that, but it's so things don't stagnate. It's a fun. This is all creating culture here. Be adventurous, creative, and open-minded. Pursue growth and learning. Build open and honest relationships with communication. So I was listening to this last night, and he said, we don't say, be honest. We say, have honest relationships. So there's a difference. Because he said, you could be honest and offend somebody. So we want to build good relationships through honesty. So I took that in mind. I thought it was a good point. Build a positive team and family spirit. Do more with less.
What else?
Be humble. Be passionate and determined. Yeah, that's the 10, I think. anyway, just an example.
Fun and weird, it embraces compassion as well, because when everyone's encouraged to just be their selves and not worried so much about how weird they might be or how weird other people are, they just kind of embrace the weirdness, you know, say,
yeah.
Okay.
It's also not judging, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you had a, like, if you had, you know, they saw it called, you know, the elevator speech? You know what elevator speech is? Elevator speech is if someone says, what do? You've got how many, it's time you're in an elevator, which is what, 15 seconds? Like, what's Kirtan Vancouver? You got 15 seconds. That's what I think every temple needs. And then I think they need to, like everything you filled in, put it in one sense. What is, if someone said, what's Kirtan Vancouver? You know, then, but something that's like, wow, that's amazing. Yes?
Well, because people wanted to use the words Krishna consciousness, for some people, I mean, for people who've been practicing, you know, chanting and hearing maybe that for a long, long time, that's something that is accessible and it may not be accessible to all people.
You have internal mission and you have external. Also.
Yeah. The external mission is, could you go back to that preacher, Srila Prabhupada, to systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large and to educate all people.
That's internal.
That's not external. ISKCON of Western.
That's your internal mission. It's not the mission for the non-devoted that you tell them.
No, that's the TEC is the internal one. That's the internal one is the executive council, the management committee. So that's not an external one. It's just what the management committee is.
What I mean by external and internal, I mean is somebody asked you, what's your mission? Why do you exist? Why does this kind of exist?
So maybe something like, we bring happiness to people's hearts.
Yeah, something like that. Or we're uplifting the consciousness. We make people happy. Why? Or, you know, Prabhupada came, his mission was to make everyone Krishna conscious. Right? Mm-hmm. But you translate that into telling somebody, like when you give someone a book, what do you say? You've got one, two, three sentences, what do you say? Book distributors, if you study the best book distributors, they're the best marketing people in ISKCON by far. And nobody's capitalized on it, right? I don't understand why. They're head and shoulders above it. What they say is incredible. They have the best lines, my experience. What's this book about? Boom, they'd say something and it's like Madison Avenue, the best book to shoot. That's, but I don't know, what I'm hearing is two things. You have mission and vision, and people define it differently, but one's more practical and one's more creating a culture. So when I say, you know, culture, you want a culture of what? What kind of culture do you want in the temple? In a culture where people respect and take responsibility, there's no criticism. People are happy, you know. Those things. So how do you create that culture?
It might be worth, because the board of directors has created the ISKCON for Western Canada mission statement. So that's basically the whole community mission vision statement. So maybe, I don't know how
it's not creating. In my mind, it doesn't create culture. It just creates it's practical. This is what we're doing. These are the foundations of our activities, missionary activities. But the internal culture. And my point is, if you don't systematically create an internal culture, like how do you all deal with one another? How do you want inner relationships to be in the temple? Like if you go, there's a store. You have Whole Foods here?
Whole Paycheck.
You have Whole Foods here. If you go to Whole Foods, you can feel there's a culture there. You can just feel it in the store. We went to a restaurant in LA and you could feel the culture of that restaurant. Oh, I'd never been to a restaurant like that. It was like the person comes up to you like this, namaste, big smile, and then after he takes our order, he says, now I have a question for you. So, what makes you most peaceful? Think about it. You know, just like they've got, just obviously they have a culture there. It's a franchise. There are like six of them. And you finish your soup, and the bottom of the bowl of soup, it says, what are you grateful for? Because it's obviously a culture they're trying to create in the restaurant. And it's called gratitude. It's called cafe gratitude. You see what I'm saying? Like somebody comes to the temple and they pick up on there's a culture, everybody's treating me in a particular way. And devotees, when I see them interacting, they're interacting in a specific way. And it's very clear. In many temples, devotees' interaction is not healthy and people see it. The culture's not there because they haven't designed it, they haven't tried to create it. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I think his point is, because they had classes to, you know, every month to treat, to help us, inspire us, and teach us how to be more respectful and responsible.
Very good question.
Does that make sense? Or am I like agitating everybody?
No, it makes perfect sense. So in order to establish such a culture, how would you then go ahead and communicate within the inner circle first and then to the expanded circle? So what's the congregation?
First, you have to come up with a culture yourself. And then, generally, what the best leaders that I've seen have created visions that are so inspiring that everybody wants to be part of it. And most people want to be, you know. So, if you create the right vision, it's automatically sold. It's like Steve Jobs never did market research. You know why? He said, because people don't know what they want to buy until I create it. Isn't that interesting? So why should I do market research? They don't know what they want. I'll create it and they'll buy it. So it's something like that. You know, you create the iPhone and then people are lining up, you know, 24 hours in advance to buy it. So if you create a vision that's so inspiring, I don't think you have to sell it. I think it'll be obvious. People will just go, yeah, this is what Krishna consciousness is. And I get a lot of books on management leadership because I'm starting to work in corporations teaching them this stuff, and I have to know it, at least the way the professionals know it. So I'm reading this book here, and the guy coined the term brilliant jerks. And a brilliant jerk is someone who is highly qualified, well-connected, the kind of person you want, but he doesn't buy into your culture. And he just ruins it for everybody. He said, I'll never hire a brilliant jerk. And he said, most HR people will just hire the brilliance, and they won't see the cultural aspect. He says, but we see that if they don't fit within the culture, they ruin everything. They disturb everyone, they dominate, they don't cooperate. So I can tell you my experience. About 40 years ago, I decided to start a company and define the culture. And the reason, there are two reasons I wanted to define the culture. One, as we're talking here, you have to define the culture. And two, to keep people away that don't fit in the culture. By defining it, they'll see what the culture is and they'll say, I don't want to be part of it. For example, integrity is part of the culture. People who don't have integrity will think, I can't buck this system. I can't exploit it. I can't take charge of it. I can't manipulate it. So they'll say, no, I don't think I want to be part of it. You agree?
Yeah.
There are people like that? So I thought, if I create this culture, it'll just keep everyone away who I'd never want to be part of it. So you might create a culture that's super, super sattvic. And the tamasic people will just, they're never going to buy into it, but that's good. Because if they don't buy into it, you're going to have problems. But at least it should be so Krishna conscious and so inspiring and so right on that 90%+ of people just go, wow, this is fantastic. At least that's what I've seen with good leaders. Their vision is so inspiring, everybody's just on board. So if you as the internal group come up with a vision that you feel, I mean, you don't have to call it mission, vision, whatever you want to call it. It's your elevator speech. Why do you exist? Not details, but why, you know, what, or not even, you don't have to call it whatever you want, but it's, you know, we call it in our company, we call it a code of honor. And that's what they were trying to do there, to create a culture. That's the culture of their company. So I think you just have a meeting about culture. How do you want your culture to look like? I think that's more important in the sense that then your mission, to me, it's nice to have, like, why do you exist? One line. That everyone knows, why do we exist? That incorporates everything you're trying to do in a very inspiring way that everybody buys into. And that's why you come. That's why you're here. Because that's what inspires you.
So we have people coming from all walks of life into the congregation, form the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have selected members from the congregation who form part of the management team with different experiences, different personal, I guess, motivations and whatnot. And they come there and arrive to get something out of it or put something into it and get something out of it. Having said all of this, how do we then, or as a, how does management then identify who to pick, who to make part of the management so that it is run smoothly without any deficiencies, as well as with the same purpose in mind, so that the actual goal is achieved?
Well, the thing, you go back to the other point, like, I was at Google last year, and I also spoke to Vaisheshika about Google, because he lives there and they do programs there. And he Vaisheshika is a very forward thinker. So he asked the people at Google, like, how do they train you? What's going on here? What's the culture here? He wants to find out why it's so successful. And so one of the things we found out, which you may know, is that when you work at Google, you don't want to work anywhere else. That's like the end of a line. Once you get there, it's like you want to stay there. Why? Because of the culture. You know anything about the Google culture? The Google culture is you can know, anybody has access to the top and can know anything that's going on. They have free access like that. There. Whatever meeting they have on any level, everybody knows, you can ask. And then every week, there's a meeting with the whole company, and then the CEO says, "This is what's going on." You know, it's completely open.
So that's sort of my next point of discussion is to establish some kind of communication method so that the inner circle is that, you know, clear on the purpose, on the agenda, and everything else surrounding the mission, and it is well recognized and accepted, so that the movement can go on smoothly. Without having hiccups and without having differences and personal differences can be on the side and so on.
Yeah, design it. But yeah, definitely. That's what I'm talking about. But in answer to your question, is you design something that works so well that they want to be part of it, they want to contribute, and then you engage people according to their talents. But now everyone's on the same page. That's what's most important. And so, you see, the thing is, this is just my experience in ISKCON, and the experience is more negative than positive in terms of culture. You will sometimes find people enthusiastic, they come to ISKCON, and then they see internal politics, and there's like, and then nobody's dealing with the internal politics. There's no system to prevent that from happening. It's like disease in the hospital and nobody's doing anything. And you go in the hospital and you get a disease you didn't have, which does happen. So I've asked devotees, I said, do you feel that some of you are more critical and petty now than before you were a devotee? And a lot of people say yes. And I say, why? I said, because I learned it in ISKCON. And I said, what could be a greater travesty than that? A greater slap in Prabhupada's face, that people learn something, take on a bad quality or characteristic that they didn't
You know, maybe they had it, but it accelerated or deepened.
I think there is a difference between a volunteer organization and a
for-profit. Sure.
There's a lot of management principles which you can apply in a profit organization versus voluntary. That's what I learned when I joined the management. I want to use the same principle, but the motivation is totally different here. We have in the profit, you have a big carrot hanging like money.
Yeah, but it's true. But all the research says money's not the greatest motivator.
It's not, but
you know what it is?
You have people with different motivations.
I agree with you. But what the research says, giving people the freedom to create is the greatest motivator.
Yeah.
So I think there are parallels because have you ever been to Dubai? That's probably one of the best managed ISKCON countries I've ever seen. I went there to do a JAPA workshop. And the day I got there, we sat down with a committee of 6 people and said, okay, how are we going to do this? Taking notes. I mean, you know, we had 340 people there. It was like a professional. I mean, they were so together. It was like so nice working with them. You could see the culture. It was professionalism. So even though it was a volunteer organization, it's all professionals running it. And but I think the key here is the why. Because if you get people to buy into the why you exist and the culture you create, then that's where all the energy comes from. That's where the dedication comes from. Of course, it's voluntary. You can't control it. You can't say work 8 hours. That's obvious. But you're going to get more energy out of people. Right? You're going to get more inspiration. I think that's the key. That's what I'm looking at. You know? Because that's what I grew up with. You know, people giving their lives because they bought into the vision, the mission. Because Prabhupada was telling us the world's going to change because of Krishna consciousness. And that's, if you ask the devotee, why are you doing what you're doing? So, because they would say, to change the world. That's what they would tell you in 19, you know.
Based on this ISKCON experience, I think that even ISKCON culture has changed over a period of 40 years. What was considered a taboo before is an in thing right now.
Yeah.
Because I know when I bought the house, I was chastised. Why are you buying a house? You're in Maya.
Yeah.
I want the words.
Yeah.
And now I'm still buying the house.
Well.
So, for this it was totally topsy-turvy.
I wouldn't say the culture has changed. I would say it didn't have culture. It was the lack of culture. But you can prevent so many problems if you define and create your culture. And if you don't, I mean, this is my experience. If you don't create it, Balabhadra just said it. He said it is what it is. If you don't try to establish certain values by which you work, I feel what's missing to one degree or another in most places I've been is that the defining of culture that causes people to just say, yes, I want to be part of this. I mean, I saw this in the avatar. It was incredible. These people were in this consciousness that we want to uplift the world. And that's what we're doing. Like, they were so dedicated. It was incredible. You know? It was like being in ISKCON in 1970. They had so much energy. And I walked out completely depressed. There was no ego between the leaders. It was amazing. I was actually depressed. I was like, I was disgusted. I said, this is like, they got along so well. Because they focused on it. That was their, you know, they worked on it. They talked about this. They talked about our egos between one another. It was all, they were talking about culture all the time. Do we talk about it? No. Then we're just, our egos kind of run loose and it's, I'm not going to work with you and you're not going to work with him. And then a new person comes and he finds out you two can't get together. And he goes, well, that's just like my office. And you're supposed to be spiritual. And you just gave a lecture on, you know, being detached. This is all bogus. I don't want to be part of it. That's what.
There's no harmony.
That's Yes.
When you're observing that kind of organization or situation, like Avatar or Google, how much do you find that the people who are creating this culture have in common with each other?
I don't know. But what from the books? Well. Let me go back a little bit, because there's one devotee who I think is brilliant, and he made a brilliant statement. And we were talking about the original 11 gurus, I think, all Americans, maybe. Geronimo. So you know what Americans are like, right? You know what 25-year-old, 30-year-old American men are like, who carry dundas. Very heavy, very autocratic, generally, to one degree or another. And of course, at that point in their Krishna consciousness, very passionate, domineering, and that's how they succeeded. And he was making the point that if ISKCON continues that way, it will destroy itself. Like, you kind of needed it, it worked then, and it can't work now. So I'm reading a lot of these books about companies. I'm reading a book, you know, I want to get, there's a book now on Google, how Google works, which I think would be important to read. I've got one on how Walmart. I'm reading a couple other books, because I'm very interested in how these companies work, because they're so successful. And so one of the things that's coming up is very amazing in these discussions. Do you know the book? You ever seen the book Egonomics? It's a book about how you have to deflate your ego within an organization for it to succeed and make money, how ego destroys it. Isn't that interesting? So let me finish in that. You know, what I'm also seeing is there's an old paradigm and a new paradigm, you know, in the way people are looking at business. And the new paradigm is a lot of the, you know, 35-year-old Buddhist practitioners who are trying to do their business in a different way. So they talk about these things, like ego. They talk about humility. You have to be humble, because then you listen to people. They talk about, there's one book I'm reading now, they talk about empathy as one of the essential qualities in business, for teams to make them work. Isn't that interesting? You know, they're talking about all these things. So basically what they're saying is they're talking all about teams. They're talking about ideas, winning over position. Steve Jobs was asked, if someone doesn't like your idea, what do you do? It's your company, you're in charge. He said, ideas win, not people. If they don't like my idea and they have a better idea, whatever we see is the best idea, that's the idea that wins. And he said, if I don't do that, every intelligent person will leave my company. In Google, 20% of your time is free time to create.
Create.
Just do whatever you want and create. So a lot of Google products were created not because they were told to create it, but they were given
freedom
to create. So they're using... What was your question again? I got sidetracked.
I was just asking how much you find the people creating
at the top
culture have in common
with
each other.
What I'm finding from reading these books is that the smart guys understand human nature, and they understand human nature and business so well that they're smart enough to do the right things, even if it's not what they would naturally do, because they know, I have to do this. Like, there's a saying, the leader of the past was the... How does it say? The leader of the past was a... He was the leader of 1,000 geniuses. No, he was a genius. The leader of the past was a genius with 1,000 followers. The leader of the future is the... What did it say? The leader of the future is the something like the supporter of 1,000 geniuses. Like Steve Jobs said, he said, I had a vision and I didn't know how to do it, and I hired people smarter than me who could do it. You know, 50 years ago, that was not the paradigm. The paradigm is, I'm the smart guy, you just do what I say. That's why Henry Ford said, the problem is, I just need hands without a brain. I need the hands to do what I tell them. But the problem is, the hands come with the brain. But the new paradigm is, it's good the hands come with the brain, because I... So my sense from reading these books is the most successful people, they kind of put their egos and natures aside, and they know it works, and they do it. And the difference, I think, I mean, I'm not an expert, I've never... You know, ran a big company. But this is my sense. My sense is that
because ISKCON is not a business, it's not like a do or die for us. If you can't build a temple in 3 years, you still live. You'll still get your chapatis and dal. The Sunday feast will still go on, right? But if Google doesn't outperform Microsoft, this one, that one, they don't have a company. So they have to be on the cutting edge. They can't afford to just, you know, in ISKCON it's like, well, you know, he left and this didn't work and we got in a fight. And so you just deal with it. But you're not competing with 40 other Gaudiya institutions in your city. So if you don't do well, it doesn't matter, right? Whereas if we thought more like a business, I think we would do much better. Many devotees said if ISKCON were a business, it would have been bankrupt 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't function on those principles. Because our survival is not, you know, the balance sheet and how much money we make. You're not paying a payroll. You're not. But if we started thinking in those terms, we would do better. The smart leaders also, they know the trends. They already see what's happening. They're there, right? They're there. Now they're in the future and they're directing themselves because they study these things. We don't do that much, right? Did we know 15 years ago there was going to be a kirtan revolution? Now we could have been in the forefront? We didn't. We didn't know. We weren't aware of that. We weren't strategically putting ourselves in. If we were a business, would we? Yeah, I think so. Don't you? Mm-hmm. When I read these books, it really concerns me. Because these guys are so clear about what makes things work and what doesn't. They study it, they go to workshops, they read books, you can tell. You know, the books I read, they're so well researched about what makes things work. So that's what I see. Or they hire people that, you know, they can't do it, but they hire people who are expert, and they bring in, all these corporations bring in training companies. Because we're trying to do it, the competition is really intense. You want to get work in a corporation, there's like, everybody's after that, doing training. My experience working with the best, I work with some amazing leaders in ISKCON, and my one experience was they had vision that motivated. That was my experience. The best leaders had vision. It was so good that you didn't have a problem selling it to everybody. It was like, wow. It's like this is everything I ever thought of and more. This is amazing. That kind of vision. So everybody, it was very easy. Everybody was just so inspired because we also saw the vision practically. It was working. Things were expanding. You know, when ISKCON, at the time Prabhupada left, up till the mid-80s, it's like a dynasty, just conquering countries. It was amazing.
So I think it falls back to the same idea of Prabhupada in his statement where we have all these elevator sannyasis and gurus and so forth who may or may not have all the management experience to run the temple, but at the same time we have very, very educated people who are becoming Krishna conscious and elevating themselves, but they don't know how sannyasis will like system to run, so they have to amalgamate
But here's the thing also, I don't know if we can equate it exactly, but Prabhupada gave people a lot of leeway to create. I mean, he gave them principles. These are the principles now go. It wasn't just like an open field, but it was fairly open. These are the principles, these are the priorities, this is what we want to establish. In general, now go for it. And then he would let them go. And then he would release them. So that's was an important part of Prabhupada's strategy. And I think that's what Google has done. And from the books I've read, they have this thing called spiritual quotient. Have you heard of that?
No.
You've heard of intelligent quotient, then they came up with emotional intelligence. Oh, yeah. Then they came up with spiritual quotient. And the way they defined that was as an individual's purpose. You know, why do you exist? Let a person create according to who they are within the company. Because people feel needs to be valued. You know, what do you do? Express yourself. They called that the spiritual quotient. I found that was the greatest, most inspirational force, is that to do what you do because you're supposed to. So you find somebody, say, what do you do? So what I do, good. Now you do it for Krishna. That's inspiration.
I think that's what basically Srila Prabhupada did.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Initially, yes.
So, the best leaders I've seen had inspiring vision, and then they knew who to engage according to their abilities. And when people are engaged according to their abilities, they're happy.
So, having said all this, in with respect to all the leaders who try to achieve the same mission, in your mind, who might be the best type of leader? Because we have aristocratic leaders, and we have top-down authority.
Yeah. So, well, I was telling Manu this morning, or yesterday, I said, I know within one day who's a good leader when I go to a temple. And you know how I know? There's no complaints.
We're fired all the time.
And you know why there's complaints? One of the main reasons? Because he won't listen to anybody. Because why are you complaining to me? If there's something wrong, you can complain to your temple president. If he listens, you don't have to complain to me. You're complaining to me because he doesn't listen. Isn't it? Right?
Yes.
Or you're complaining, maybe it's not managed well, that's why you're complaining. And you know, he'll listen, but he can't do anything. That might be one scenario. He's just incapable. Generally, that's not the problem I see. The problem is you can't talk to him about it. Well, what's worse is if he's incapable and you can't talk to him, then you're in double trouble. If he's incapable, at least you can talk to him. What the success formula, I feel, is a good leader has vision, and then he makes the vision with his team, he shares it with the congregation, and then he facilitates people. How can we reach this vision? And he lets everybody run with it. So even if he's not good himself as on the practical level of accomplishing things, he's got, this is Steve Jobs, he didn't know how to write software. He got people to do it. You understand?
There's a difference. Yes, I do. But there's a difference in the way organizations run at a business level than for an organization to run such as ISKCON, which is a non-profit, because here, people are not working for the money motivator, but motivates them to, I guess, you know, get extra power, whatever, the control of, I don't know what they want. How do you then train them, teach them to work as a team in different segments within the organization?
My experience, and I think this is crucial, this is my experience as a teacher, and it's a very interesting point, that I find it extremely difficult to teach anything which the culture in which I'm teaching doesn't support. Because if I teach you one thing, and you leave here, and every devotee you see does the opposite thing, you can't learn what I've taught. And if every devotee does what I teach, you don't need me to come here and teach it, because you'll learn it from them. So, anything you want to teach anybody, you have to create within your own group first, and then within the broader temple. Because the culture then teaches it.
Because you know, in an organization, you don't have deterrence. You come in time, or you get fired.
Yeah.
Here we don't. Or let's say...
But you can create that culture. In a non-profit, you can create that culture. If you all agree that that's the culture you want. So, okay... You have your management team, right? You can create a culture. You can all decide that we must come on time to meetings, we must come on, show up on time, this and that. And if we're not, we're going to get called on it. And if we get called on more than three times in a year, then we all agree. If I blow it,
I'm out, I'm off the team.
You can do that. You can do anything you want. That's
so
for you to decide.
So is it fair to say that we could also have some rules laid down
totally
rather than here? And say
if you all agree and enforce it. The key is you have to enforce it.
And yes, correct. And pull everybody in and make everybody clear on the expectations.
Yeah. But you've all agreed on them, so that's the power. Because it's not Manu saying, if you don't show up on time, you're out. If you miss it three times. It's all of you deciding. He doesn't show up three times, he's out.
I will.
It's like
and I don't show up.
Yeah, no, he doesn't have to be president.
Then again, it falls back to communication and the way it seems like it's received and the way it's...
This goes back to the point that ISKCON needs to run more like a business. And I think, imagine there were 40 Gaudiya movements in Vancouver right now. Would you be doing things differently? Yes, you would, for sure. Would you be more together? You have to be. Otherwise, all your people are going to go to the place that is showing the most respect, the most honor, has the best classes, the best kirtans, the best prasadam, right? The place that's engaging people, and people feel most welcome and comfortable. Isn't it? So,
yeah.
What's a nice meditation.
What kind of temple is moving in next door?
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to win?
Bhakti.
If you have it, if you show it.
Is there anything going on around the world in ISKCON how to run a temple nicely then? Anyone coming forward?
Everywhere I go, they have something that is praiseworthy. Some temples have more. But my concern is the team. My concern is the, and I'm just reading a book that stated very clearly that IQ has nothing to do with the success of the team. You know? The main ingredients of the success of the team? Should I read it to you?
Yes.
Very interesting. You're interested in Karmi books? Is it bona fide? Not by Prabhupada, but it's everything. It's just confirming through research everything I've seen with my own eyes. I mean, there's a lot to read. I can't read everything. But this is titled "The Discovery of Group IQ." That there's a group IQ. What they discovered is that no individual can accomplish what a good team can accomplish, what a functional team can accomplish. They said an individual is more successful than a dysfunctional team.
Yes.
But a functional team,
more successful than
an individual. Yeah, an individual cannot compete with a functional team. And they said in this day and age, now everyone is specialized. So you need teams because everybody's got a special talent and one person can't have the mastery of all those skills. And because people are getting more specialized, they need other people. So then they're questioning what causes a team to work, and they discover there's a thing called team IQ. What makes teams effective? People have been trying to answer that for centuries. Researchers from MIT and Union College discovered something fundamentally new about the issue when they approached it in a new way. They noticed that groups take on a character of their own. They become living things distinct from the individual natures of their members. The researchers wondered if the groups could be measured as integrated entities on one particular dimension, intelligence. Could there be some common factor that affects a group's performance on a wide range of disparate tasks? If so, it would be extremely valuable to know about and measure them. IQ turns out to be surprisingly powerful. IQ has long been controversial, and it certainly doesn't measure everything we want to know about a person. But its predictive power is solidly established. As the researchers observed, It is a reliable predictor of a very wide range of important life outcomes, including grades in school, success, and life expectancy. What if something similar existed for groups? So, they called it collective intelligence. Collective intelligence is a predictor of the performance of tasks that were used. So, okay, I'll read the areas I starred are the most important. So, the researchers asked a crucial question: does collective intelligence tell us anything that we couldn't figure out just by measuring the IQs of a group's individual members? So they measured all those IQs and found that the average IQ of a group member was worth little in predicting the group's performance. The IQ of the smartest member was worthless. Even the most effective group doesn't need the smartest person. So they told the story. It's really interesting. Would you like to hear it?
Yeah. What is the test based on?
It tells you. I don't want to drop the beans yet. It's keep you in suspense for a little bit. They have this thing called the Ryder Cup, which is the 12 best American golfers against the 12 best European golfers. Right? And the Americans lose practically every time. So they got this one man who's, I don't know if he was coaching them every year, but anyway, this year he understood something about group dynamics. So he said the problem was these 12 golfers, through the whole season in America, they compete amongst one another. And then they bring them together to now compete, and they're used to competing amongst one another. So they'd always lose because they weren't forming a cohesive group. So he formed them into four groups based on their natures so that we get along well. And he said, your duty is to support one another. You have whatever you do, just think how it's going to help the other person. And they formed these groups because the key ingredient was they were like one another. So because they were like one another, they got along really well. And because they got along really well, that was the key. That was the key ingredient. They got along well. Because they got along well, and he said, support one another, they won. That was why they won, because they formed the group. They became a dynamic group, and that's how they were able to achieve it.
Same thing happens in amateur, like when they go to World Cup, kind of picks up a team from all the Canadian teams we play in America, mm-hmm. and America, like Canada, and they compete against each other on the regular amateur season. When they go to the World Cup, they are together.
Yeah. It's a different.
But they depend on the coach. Yeah.
And if they're not used to working together, then okay. The researchers then asked the most important question: if individual intelligence doesn't explain a group's effectiveness, what does? Which is what you're asking. They investigated some popular candidates: group cohesion, motivation, and satisfaction. None of them meant a thing. Isn't that interesting? The stability of the team and its size mattered only a little. How about such fine-sounding concepts as having a clear, challenging, meaningful vision and specifying well-defined roles and responsibilities and giving team members appropriate rewards, recognition, and resources? They were unimportant. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, filtering my mind.
You want to know what it is, don't you? You have to read the book. What meant a lot, however, was social sensitivity. So we have to define what that means. Group members each took a widely used test called reading the mind in the eyes, which requires you to choose a word that best describes people's thoughts or feelings based only on photos of their eye region. In other words, what they were doing is they would give you a test, and you would see the eyes of someone in a photo, and you would say, what are they thinking or feeling? And the higher your score you got on that, which means the more you were sensitive to people, emotions and feelings, and you know, you could vibe with people, the better you were as a team member. And then the higher the score of the people, the more effective the teams. Isn't that interesting? That they could vibe with one another, basically. They kind of understood one another. There's other factors, I'll read. But a lot of this ultimately is common sense, but it's nice to have the research. If you wanted to predict a group's effectiveness, the best thing you could do was look at the member's average score on that test. Conversational turn-taking also made a big difference. Groups dominated by a few talkers were less effective than those in which members had more equal turns. So that was an additional aspect. Yeah. People who dominate, we have a problem in ISKCON with dominators, don't we? Because when you have a position, somehow or other, I don't know what it is. You're supposed to know everything. Another way to predict the most effective groups was much simpler. Just count the number of women. This is really interesting. That's because in this research and much other research, women perform a great deal better than men in measures of social sensitivity. So, you know, we have this idea, you know, put six women in a room and they'll go crazy. That's living together. It's easier for men to live together, but it's not about working together. That's what they found. The finding is just one of several reasons that women seem strongly positioned to excel in emerging economy. So if you watch how girls play and how boys play, it's different. You ever watch? Do you know anything about them? Boys will tend to play against one another more. Girls tend to play together. Did you know that?
Just their nature.
Yeah, that's their nature. They'll play more together. Men, boys will play more competitive against. And you'll see most of the girls in competitive sports, they look kind of like men. Have you noticed that? They tend to be a little more male. But that male is very competitive, I think. So they have this term, collective intelligence. Collective intelligence seems too narrow a term for what the researchers detected. It's more than intelligence as we usually think of it, because it's based in large part on tasks that groups really perform. It might be better to be called group effectiveness. So they're saying it's not really intelligence, it's group effectiveness. And the keys to it, to a group's ability to come up with ideas or plan an activity or reach a moral judgment or solve a hard problem, are the subtlest elements of human interaction. Sensing the proper meaning of a furrowed brow or noticing someone's silent wish to contribute to a conversation. It's just understanding people. That was the skill that made the best team.
That's why, I'm sorry to interrupt, that's why if you notice these days, many in the hospitality industry, small franchises like, for example, BQ, or you name it, McDonald's, or whatever it is, many workers in the front line are women. Anybody higher in the hierarchy are usually men.
Uh-huh.
You notice that, right?
They also found if people were more empathetic, they would do more business. Like if a customer's complaining and you listen, you go, wow, that's really bad. You know, they immediately like you. They also found that when they did an experiment with bank tellers, and they told bank tellers, just give the money like this, or put it down. And they told other bank tellers, put the money in their hand and hold their hand while you put the money into it. And they said everybody had super positive feeling for the people who touch them. So I really like that bank. That's a really good bank. Mm-hmm. So if everyone in the bank does that, you'll think that's a good bank. Interesting. Hmm? Group performance remains an increasingly valuable human activity, even as computers learn to read facial nuance and otherwise detect feelings. The simple reason is that we, not computers, decide what our problems are and ultimately choose the best solutions. Anyway, the point of this is social interaction is what builds teams. So, from my perspective, this is just me, and you can take it or leave it, but I think the most important thing a leader can do is build a good team. As a leader, you have your limitations. And I think that's what Prabhupada did. He built teams, and he let us run with the ball. And that's how Krishna consciousness spread. So then answer to your question, if we build a good team here, it sets an example for the other people who now come into the team, and if they're dysfunctional, they can't throw it off. But if you have a dysfunctional team, you bring it'll attract more dysfunctional people.
So let me ask you this question.
You agree?
Now,
does that make sense?
Yes, to an extent. So, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
But to expand on it further, what is the deciding criteria on who to pick and choose to be able to designate into that particular position to manage that area, per se?
I think if you have a good team, you automatically will know. Well, okay. If you want to create culture, you have to train people. So I think it's a really great idea. Create a culture, define it, teach yourselves, practice it, and when new people come in, teach them. Because if they fit within the culture, then everything's fine.
So I guess to narrow my question as to how do you find the person who's fit for the position?
They may not be. My point is they may not be, and you have to train them to be.
Because you have to get a mix.
Okay. There's a story. The HR guy is training a new HR rep, right? And I think Prabhupada tells a similar story. They interview two people. One has more skills and more expertise than the other. So the guy being trained says, so we'll hire the guy with the expertise. He says, no, we're going to hire the other guy. He said, why? He said, because the guy with the skill, when he came into the office, he opened the door and he didn't close it. And the other guy came in and said, he's going to be hard to train. And Prabhupada tells a similar story. Have you heard a story?
Yeah.
Is that the same story?
Same story.
Maybe that was adapted, you know. So that, and I agree with that 100%. Because if you create a culture and you have people that all your team is able to work together and cooperate the way you want, then you don't want anybody else just because they're expert. And if they're really expert, maybe they'll do little tasks here and there, but they won't be in the inner circle because they'll disturb it.
Okay. Then again, it falls back to the same question of Prabhupada's statement. How do you find a perfect match between a sannyasi and somebody who's able to run a particular area of the organization?
I think it goes back to culture. Because what you can do, for example, you create a culture, but somebody could come in and disrupt it because he's a sannyasi.
Exactly.
So then you educate the sannyasi. This is the culture. This is what we're doing. This is how we want it done. I think that's a much more intelligent way to do it. Mm-hmm. It creates cohesion. And then maybe that sannyasi can't function in that. You say, well, Maharaj, if you can't function in it, you know, I don't know what we can do, but maybe you shouldn't visit here because it's you know, it'll upset the equilibrium we've created. And maybe other sannyasis will be attracted to work with you because they like that culture.
And then also, again, it falls back to the influential aspect of the leadership quality in the individual just trying to get things accomplished.
But I think if we go back to the vision and mission, that's because, let's say I'm not a great leader, but I'm great at facilitation, and I could facilitate you all to come up with this amazing vision. That makes me a great leader. In that sense, it wasn't my vision, it was your vision, but now we have the vision. Right? And I think some leaders, that's what they do. They may not have the intelligence, the business acumen, but they have the ability to get it out of other people. Isn't it? You know, every great king had his ministers, and his smartness was that he could listen to different ideas. That's also a sign of a good leader. When he hears a good idea, he knows this is the right idea. You tell me, and I'm smart enough to know which idea is best. Chanaka Pandit says a king without ministers is finished. So, I mean, that's what makes a good president, right? He comes in, how much training does he have to run a country? But he's got all these people giving him advice, and he's got to be smart enough to know. Yeah. And he creates a good team. If he creates a good team, it'll be doing well. So I think that's really a key element of a good leader is create a good team. A team in which each individual can express themselves fully. And this is a big topic. Peter Berwash talked about it. Any of you read Peter Berwash's book? He made an interesting statement, and this has come up in so many books I read, and it's a principle of Google. He said that, I don't know if this is true now, but he said typically in restaurants, when they would make up a new menu, the management would make up a new menu, and they wouldn't ask the waiters or waitresses. They said, those are the most important people to ask, because people will always ask, do you have this, do you have that? So they're the ones that need to contribute, right? He said, but typically they wouldn't ask them. So the good leader, he's getting input. And another quality of a good leader is he listens. Even to people he doesn't agree with, he listens. And he looks and says, maybe there's an idea there. Just because I don't agree with it doesn't mean it's not good. So I think you don't have to be this incredibly intelligent person to do amazing things. You don't have to be a Bill Gates. But you can get good people and facilitate them, and they can do it. I think Radha Swami is an example of that. He's got amazingly good people, and he's got amazing vision. His vision is incredible. But he's not doing it. He's giving it, and the other people are doing it. Mm-hmm. And he's working with them also to develop their vision. And I think what a good leader does is kind of, he points you in the direction, this is the direction, you refine it. Here's the idea, you refine it. This is what we want, refine it. And you get good people.
I think there is a book out there called The Power of Influence, or How to Influence People, one of the two. I think that has some really relevant points on what you're saying right now. Mm. Sorry, I have to excuse myself because I have to do service at the temple.
I, when I read these books, I think it's common sense, ultimately. They're not using it. Common sense, yes.
Ultimately, my realization is that all these motivation books, if you follow the scriptures to the T, they are coming from there. That's why I stopped going to any more motivational scriptures. I used to go initially for 3-4 years,
really?
And I got the essence.
Yeah.
I said, waste of my time and money. And secondly, the overall my relation is how to manage everybody's ego, including your own false ego.
Yeah.
That's a good leader, has to manage everybody's false ego, including his own. Yeah. Because sometimes your ego comes in the way.
Okay, well, here's another point. And I think this is it's something we all experience and is very clear. The consciousness of the leaders, it is affecting everybody. Right? So the leader's got a big ego, he's got a small ego, it's affecting everyone. But that's very, very important. You know, I have a friend, she spent a weekend with a couple counseling them. Their marriage was really bad. And the guy is the CEO of a big company. And I saw her like the Monday after she came back, I hadn't seen her in like a year. So, you know, we talk about human behavior because that's what she does. And she said, dealing with this guy, his relationship with his wife is that it's upsetting the whole company. She's affecting the whole company. You know. So she said, it would really be powerful to do marriage workshops in companies because the employees, they're all being affected by what's going on at home. So, if I were to put everything I wanted to say into like a few sentences, I would say it this way, that we have to reflect Krishna consciousness in our leadership and management. You take that as a principle, right? How to get rid of false ego, how to inspire, how to give people room, how to be exemplary, right? Whatever example you set, that's a standard. If someone says, why should I go? Why should I do this? Their excuse will be, the temple president doesn't do it, the leaders don't do it. That's what they'll always say. But they can't say that when he does it.
Not sure.
And when you're doing it, and you can say, do it.
Yeah, not sure.
Yeah, you can't, yeah. So, but If you study these other companies, these guys are cutting edge. They're very inspired. They have huge vision. They're really moving forward. And you can feel the energy in there. And it's a different energy than we have here. Our energy tends to be very stagnant. You know, it sounds almost like, I feel in many of our temples, I feel like we're rowing upstream. We're not rowing downstream. We're trying to like maintain equilibrium. You know, it's almost like the boat's going to sink and we keep patching it. That's unfortunate.
The other thing is like we are trying to say anti-materialism most of the time. I would be anti-materialism. So that also creates some kind of a questionable situation in people's mind. On one side, the materialism is very bad and things like that, and we use the technique from that. So
okay.
That's why I'm saying if you follow our scriptures to the T, it comes from the all the management. Modi speaks after the
Yeah, but I would say, I agree with you, but I would say those guys are better presenting it than we are.
Yeah, of course. Because we are not practicing 100%.
So, no, not even that. We may be lacking in understanding people's mentality so that we can present it in a way to get them to accept it, you know, to get and find that in. And that's what a lot of these guys are really good at. They're on the same frequency as those people, and they know exactly how to get in. And one great exercise, whenever you run into a problem and you say, we can't do this, you just ask the question, is that absolutely true?
No.
And if it's not absolutely true, well, sometimes you don't know until you study the market or study. But if you assume it's not absolutely true, then you have to start thinking, okay, what can I do differently now? And I think this is so important in spreading Krishna consciousness. Because otherwise we might think we can't do anything, it's just the way it is. And then, right, you go to the store and then, you know, like 10 years ago, all of a sudden, Bhakti Fest. And it's like, what's this? And it's not even devotees. What's going on? You know? Krishna Das, you tune in, he's on the airplane. You're listening to kirtan on the airplane with Krishna Das. Like, what? You know? And it just makes you think, like, what universe do I live in? Why aren't we doing that? I feel strongly that if our movement stayed the way it was when Prabhupada was here, I would all that stuff would have been done long before anybody else by us. I have no doubt about it. Because that's the way it was going. Because it had that energy. So to me, it's all about, leadership is about energy. What kind of energy you're creating in people? How much energy are you extracting from them voluntarily? That's the way Prabhupada did it. People giving their lives voluntarily. That's a good leader.
But also this cons situation that you come to that level because there were so many kind of bad situations.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So that kind of took people, particularly the first generation devotees. Yeah. Look at the second generation devotees.
Yeah.
First generation would give their life.
Yeah.
What about their children? Are they even 50% of their life? No. 90% no.
Yeah.
Hardly 10% maybe.
Yeah.
So that's something about our own society as such. What we have.
Well, don't you think it's a lack of good leadership? I mean, amongst other things. I feel that. I mean, you go to Hungary. There's an amazing community there. It was not affected by any of that. So because they had a good leader who was steady. So if you have, you can, you know, everyone likes Manu. If Manu stays here and does well, you'll never have those problems again. Isn't it? You agree?
Yeah.
And you build on it. And you want to create a dynamic community where people are inspired. Because all of you are inspired, and you're all inspired by your vision, and you're creating a culture that's inspiring. And the culture then is creating people and teaching. I mean, this point is so important. I've given so many workshops, and I feel I'm very clear on what I teach, but I know if the culture doesn't support it, I'm going uphill. Even though what I said, it's right, it's true, it's clear, it's practical, everything you need to do this is there, but what about your culture? And if the culture were there, I wouldn't need to teach it. They would learn through the culture. So that's my experience. You agree?
Yeah.
That we learn through culture much more than
information. Because you are gone after 2 days, but what remains is
what you see.
Yeah.
Yes.
One interesting struggle that we seem to have in many communities is a consensus on what actually is Krishna consciousness. So can you comment on that?
Let me address another issue and see if it addresses this.
Mm-hmm.
We came from a one guru movement, so any controversy was solved by Prabhupada within the time it takes to get him the controversy and get the response and get it out to people. It's generally 1 to 3 weeks. So you know, if the Rithvik thing came up, maximum 3 weeks it would have been finished. Now we're in, I think it came up in like 86 or something. 87. So here we are, you know, 38 years later, debating it. So then when Prabhupada left, we even had more of a one guru culture. But it was just split into 11. So what I noticed was people did not learn social skills because they were working through a leader. So I'm working to please the leader, you're working to please the leader, we'll do whatever he says, even if we don't even know we don't get along. You have that experience? I don't know I don't get along with you because I'm just doing what he told me, and he told me to go out and distribute books with you and be nice to you, so I'm nice to you. But when he's gone, I realize I don't like you, and I start criticizing you. So it's a dynamic that we've gone through, right? That sometimes leaves people without skills to get along, because when the leader decides, I'm backing off, you do it yourself, everybody realizes we never learned to get along. And we never learned how to resolve these philosophical issues. At Lachua Temple is an example of the complete opposite. There's never been a guru there, one guru. The GBC is not dominant. They don't make decisions for everybody. It developed totally on inspiration. It's a unique dynamic. I've never seen it anywhere in ISKCON, and it's so interesting to watch because there's so much that goes on. Book distribution, you know, they go Lachua, retired. They're doing book distribution. They distributed 4,000 books in the month of August as a marathon for Prabhupada. It's amazing. Or the month of July, yeah. They do prasadam distribution at two colleges. They've got cows. They've got all this stuff, and it wasn't autocratic. It was just people's inspiration to do it. It's a different dynamic. So as that devotee said, I don't think the future will be the dominant guru. That can't sustain itself. I think the future is going to be people who are going to have to learn to get along. And if you and I don't agree philosophically, we're going to have to figure out how to exist within the temple and continue. That requires a level of social maturity that I don't think a lot of, you know, religious institutions have developed. But I think we need it. And, it depends what the issue is, obviously. If it's a major issue, that could be the question between something that is against what Prabhupada taught, where if it's nuanced, well, it could be this or it could be that, that's obviously easier. I am concerned about communities dominated by one person. There's some side of me that says it's a really powerful paradigm while they're here, but when they go, and what we've seen in ISKCON, some of them have left, but it's left a trail of he's the guru. If you don't, you know, to other people outside, we're not his disciples. It has that tendency. So, what do you think?
Well, I think that's very interesting. See if I was like the consensus part about. I appreciate what you just said, because it's a consensus and a greater, like a community consensus instead of an individual based consensus.
Yes.
It's like there's more cohesiveness. And I was thinking of
sustainability.
Sustainability, yeah. But there's another side of the lack of consensus. Which is, I've got my own personal thoughts on it.
Okay.
Which I think are largely to do with the disconnect we've had from the mission of the actual mission itself, and so many of the early devotees like yourself, and so many who actually were so immersed in the Sankirtan movement, that later on in devotional years, it's like second nature, understanding the essence of what it's all about.
Yeah.
And so you have another wave of devotees coming who never actually got immersed in the Sankirtan movement and actually don't know what it's all about. So when it comes time to identify what is devotional service and what is not, sometimes it's an issue in leadership. Like, for example, at this temple, there have been people who have not been acknowledged to be engaged in devotional service because it's not at the temple, for example. That's just one example. So this, to me, speaks to the problem about what is the devotional service that is the cohesive thing? What actually keeps ISKCON together as ISKCON, which is the Sankirtan movement, but it seems to be something that's escaping us a little bit.
Yeah, well, leadership. Okay, you brought up a good point, because I've noticed the same thing, because many of us joined living in the temple. Now the majority of people joined have never lived in the temple.
Yeah.
And they don't get the training we've got or the experience we've got. And then I definitely think that has to be addressed. And I think Radhanaswami addresses it by just having his yatras, you know, where people spend 2-3 weeks together. So they get an experience of, you know, they're following a program. And we developed, when I was on last year, we developed a course called the Sadhana Retreat, where we would take everybody out for a weekend. Everybody got to live like they lived in a temple, some retreat center, and just get that. And I think it's a matter of educating people when they come in. I don't know the best way to do it, but I think it's important. And all my godmothers recognize it. It's a much different paradigm then. And a lot of people don't get the basics that we got. So it's... When you were talking, I was thinking, let's say you run into an issue like this, or any issue where you find some discrepancy, difference of opinions or something. So you all come together and just talk about it and say, these are the two sides, let's discuss it. Maybe you can't agree. And say, okay, let's throw this out to 10 people in this room. Each one of you, pick your favorite person and ask them this question. And let's come back and discuss. There's a very important thing for us to understand. One devotee introduced me to this. He must have read it somewhere. You have an idea, I have an idea. And so generally, the discussion is like, who's right? So we discuss it. I make my points, you make your points. Can I convince you? Can you convince me? Are we? Neither of us convinced. Do we then compromise? So he said the formula is, it's 1 + 1 = 1, meaning I defeat you, you defeat me. So we get 1 point. Or we compromise. So then it's 1 + 1 = 1/2. 1 + 1 = 1, because it's half you and half me. And then he said there's a third option, whereas we came up with a better idea, which is different from your idea, different from my idea. So then 1 + 1 = 3. Or 11. I say 11. But I really like that, because I think that's here's another way of answering your question. And this idea came to me because I was in a temple that I used to run, and it's not being run well now. And I kept asking the devotees, if it goes like this, what's it going to look like in 80 years? And every time I asked that question, they just put their head down. I said, oh my God. You know? And I think that's a powerful question. So, in other words, if, let's say, we can't resolve these differences maturely, then I ask you the question, if this continues, what will this going to look like in 80 years? And you'll put your head down also. It can't exist this way. We have to be able to, isn't it? At least that's the way I feel. I don't see it can be strong unless we learn how to work out these differences in a way that we can remain loyal to Prabhupada and still engage everybody and not make people feel there's something wrong with them. And maybe also what you're saying, maybe it's a reality and it's just a new reality that you can't really completely solve, because no matter how much training you do, it can't replace living in a temple for 10, 15 years. Right? It's just, you know, they'll get that when they become Vajrapas. Maybe that's a reality. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. It could be. And then you have to deal with that reality. But if you want to do an amazing exercise, you get your group together and you say, what do we want ISKCON to look like in 80 years? And you all come up with ideas. And you may look at book distribution, he may look at temples, he may look at something else, she may look at academia, and how ISKCON how we want to be known in academia. He may look at how we want to be known politically. What, you know. And then you go back and say, now, what are we doing? How are we doing now? What do we have to change? It's a really powerful exercise. It's called Future Search. It's a whole workshop.
But isn't the strategic planning people are supposed to be doing it?
What?
Is strategic planning best for the whole thing is all about, I understand.
Perhaps. Yeah. We did this last year. They didn't call it strategic planning. But there's a book called Future Search, which lets you examine your whole history, where you got to, where you... So I mean, my personal feeling is that there are cracks in the wall that, if not healed, are going to knock the building down. And I don't think we're afraid of them. And I think, you know, we have energy and enthusiasm, so even the cracks are there, we can hold them together. But if we don't mend them or build a new, better structure, I think it's going to crack. Because I don't think we can go on dysfunctionally a long time without people just losing faith. And there's, you know, there's other movements to join. Right? My experience and my very strong feeling is mature devotees discussing can come up, can work together. If they just sit down and discuss without ego. You know, and the whole idea is what's the best thing, not who's right. That's the no ego platform. It's not about who's right, it's about what's best. And I've been in situations like that where I couldn't push my idea because nobody would take it. And my ideas, objectively, were better. Because I was in a poor third world country and I was bringing in American ideas and they didn't want them. And then the country modernized and now they're doing all the things I told them to do 30 years ago. But my ideas were good, but it was the wrong time. So I stood back and let them do what they wanted to do. And it worked. I just had to quiet my ego. So I feel confident that we do that and we discuss with the goal of what's the best and not who's right. We'll be fine. If we don't do that, we're going to have trouble attracting qualified, intelligent people. Because when they see the dysfunction, they'll just get disgusted. Do you agree? He's an example. Yes?
You mentioned, and actually what Prabhu said brought up the question back in my mind. You said that Srila Prabhupada had encouraged his disciples to go out and give them space to do what they wanted, but he gave them certain principles and guidelines.
Yeah.
So what are examples of some of those principles?
Like general instruction, book distribution, but how to do it? In fact, he was against showing how to do it. Did you know that? Some devotees wanted to teach how to do it, and he said, that's artificial. He said, every man is his own genius. So he was college preaching. The first Gurukul, you know how the first Gurukul was established? Gurukul? Because a devotee read in the first canto that children should be educated from the age of 5. And he got the inspiration to start a Gurukul. That's how it started. As far as I know, Prabhupada did not tell him to do it. He did it and wrote Prabhupada and said, we're going to do this. Brings Sankirtan means to bring the holy name to people. A devotee decided to get a bus and make a temple. It was not Prabhupada's idea. When Prabhupada heard it, he said, this is fantastic. This is better than the temple. The temple goes through the people. So, devotees wearing devotional dress, non-devotional dress, to be able to approach people better. It was all the innovation. But, okay, here are the parameters. Distribute books, do lectures, do programs, distribute prasadam, you know, within all these areas. Speak scientifically, this and that. It was just like, you know, as you became creative, you saw unlimited ways to spread Krishna consciousness. And so, anything, the criteria, as far as I've understood, Does it make people Krishna conscious, and does it make you Krishna conscious? Because sometimes it makes people Krishna conscious and puts you in mind. Like you're doing rock and roll, everybody's chanting, you're doing every night till 1 a.m. And after, you know, 3 months, you're finished. So it made them, but it didn't make you. So Prabhupada would sometimes stop it because it was having adverse effects on the devotees. The program was fine. We had a rock and roll band with dramas. You know, we had street dramas in New York back in the day. They had theater in the New York Temple. Prabhupada loved theater. But he didn't say what play to do. He just said theater. And they developed their own dramas. So like that. The parameters were, you know, within devotional principles. Obviously. It's pretty broad. It was very few restrictions that I've ever seen. Sometimes the restriction was, let's say, a leader wanted to do something, like a creative art project, but he needed to run a temple, and that would be a distraction. Prabhupada said, don't do it. You want to make a movie, so we can get movie makers, they'll make the movie. You're a GBC, you have to do this. So those restrictions were there, based on responsibility. But otherwise, very few limitations, because it was rare devotee would do anything that was against our principles. From what I've seen. So, now, in India, Prabhupada was hands-on because we didn't know how to deal with Indians. But in the West, he was hands-on. Only a few things he would control. He was very focused on book distribution, the way the books would look, the kinds of paintings, all of that. But that was his personal project. So he didn't turn that over to other people. He was very careful about that. But other things, how we distribute the books, and how the temple rooms look like, and careful about deity worship, that had to be proper, but the color of the temple building, the floor, it's a church, a house, none of that. But in India, he had a plan for India, and he knew we couldn't manage well, so he was on top of it. But in the West, no. He said, you know, you're Westerners, you know what to do. It's your country. Now, another thing which I think has changed, and I briefly talked about it. When the movement started, we were hippies preaching to hippies. So we were in an optimal position because we knew how they thought, because we thought the same way. We were them. So we didn't have to do market research. How do hippies think? What are they like? But then it changed from hippies to yuppies. The 80s was yuppies. And we're still hippies. And we didn't relate so well. We were preaching to yuppies like hippies, and it didn't work. So we started the 80s, like from my experience in preaching in America, that was the time where we made the least number of devotees. That was the lowest period. Because it evolved. The 70s was still a little hippie-ish. The late 70s, early 80s, what became yuppie-ish. We lost the boat there. And then the yoga scene really grew, and we missed the boat until recently. On that, in the kirtan scene. So we weren't adapting. So that, I think that was a mistake. And I think some devotees were reticent to adapt because they wanted to keep it the way it was when Prabhupada was here.
It still is going on. It still there is some.
It's going on in some places. Yeah. Yes?
Well, I was wondering about the GBC envisioning for the future of ISKCON. So I know that there was some discussions this past year and maybe in previous years about, you know, all the Srila Prabhupada's disciples are now aging out and passing on, and so what's about the future? And I don't know if you have information on that and if there has been some visioning already for ISKCON in 80 years.
We did that this year, the visioning of this garden in 8 years.
We had 8 years, sorry.
What?
Vision of this garden?
80 years.
80 years.
And it's all divided into sections. Book distribution, Prabhupada's position, for an ashram. You know, I forget, but there were different areas. Education, what we want. So that was done this year. And there is a strategic planning committee called Succession, which is how we're going to go into the future. And part of that, I believe, although I'm, you know, kind of giving secondhand information, but as far as I understand, maybe someone knows, they developed this management training program as part of that succession program to train future leaders. And I also understand there's talk about supporting managers, because once they're trained, if they're grihasthas, it's difficult for them to take positions in ISKCON because they have to earn a living. So there's talk about, starting to talk about supporting them. Because if we train them and we don't support them, then they're, it's going to be difficult for many. I think what should be really healthy for all of you is to discuss anything that you feel needs to discuss it. And be very honest and open. And I think it's very important, and I think you'll make a lot of progress. For example, there's something that I look at. You see something for 10, 20 years and it doesn't resolve itself. And you kind of understand why. Because of the way ISKCON is, it can't resolve itself. So we always have that program. And unless we change something, it doesn't resolve itself, right? One of these examples is temple presidents, good leaders. How many good leaders do you have in ISKCON? So let's say you have X number of good leaders. Right? How many bad leaders do you have that are running temples who don't want to run temples? You say you have X numbers. Where are you going to get good leaders? You say, well, we have the training college. Then what? How are they going to do it? Well, if you don't pay them, how many can do it? You say, not many. So you look at that and you realize we have a paradigm where practically we can't get good leaders to run most of our temples unless there's money to pay them, right? So just looking at a problem, it's just real. You don't even have to have a solution, but just the reality. When he retires, who's the next leader? And say, okay, he can be the next leader, but he needs $5,000 a month. Where does that come from? He's got a job. He's making $5,000 a month. He can't leave it. That's his overhead. He's happy to be the temple president. So that when you leave, who do you have? Or you get ill. Who's your vice president? Right. How much could you do with a vice president? Oh, I could do so much. How about two vice presidents? How about three? You know? That's the way I like to think. Not practically, but just theoretically. What would be an ideal model? And then from there, say, could we actually make this? And I always like to ask the question is, if we don't have this, what is the future going to look like? And that's where reality is. Because you realize the future doesn't look good. It's not stable if you don't have that. So I think these kinds of discussions are good. They're so real. You know, because we in ISKCON, we're always piecing things together. It's not stable, right? So we have you. What if we don't have you? What will we have? If you weren't here to be the temple president, what will we have? You want to do it? Could you do it? Do you have the time? Maybe, maybe not. You want to do it? No. So what do we have? What do we have? Well, we'll manage by committee. What do they say? There's no statutes of committees. So what are we drawing? But you think in your mind, well, he could do it, he could do it, he could do it, or he could be trained, but we don't have the, you know, how would he do it? He can't. So when you look at the pool, who you can pull, who can you pull from? Brahmacharis. How many brahmacharis do you have? One? Two? How many would like to do it? Zero. So, you know, when you actually look at it, and like I said, if this were a business, would you do something about it? Of course you would. But as a non-profit, somehow we don't think about it. I don't think that's good. I don't think it's a good idea at all.
The similar, yes. Like they're training so many brahmacharis in Mayapur, yeah. In deity worship and all.
Yeah.
And they could have come out, every one of them there. And then they come out different places, they do not settle in the country, and that creates a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fact of life, it's
exactly.
happening.
Exactly.
And there are so many examples. They were trained in Gurukul. They didn't have any of the training, and then all of a sudden something happens, they cannot stay in the temple for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Then they start their life again at the age of 40, 35, 40, 41.
Yeah.
They don't have any experience in the material world, and they feel really bitter about it.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Yeah.
It's a live example we have.
Yeah. I think it's great. I think these are great discussions.
But then what you do about it? Just
yeah, that's the second half of the discussion. I can tell you one thing. Your solutions are going to have to be different than the way things have been.
Of course. Because the culture has changed. As I told, the whole ISKCON culture has changed in the last 100 years.
That's the problem.
Yeah. And we are still stuck in the old culture.
And that's the joke. I read this joke. I don't know if it's a joke. They say, you're in a church, they're having a meeting, and someone says, why are you doing something this way? Because he sees it's not working. And the answer is, it's the way we've always done it. I think that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And you will find in ISKCON management circles, sometimes if you propose an idea to solve this problem, because it's different, in immediate responses it gets rejected. No, because we've never done it that way. But if you don't do some way different, the problem continues. I'll give you a good example. In Mayapur and Gurukul, the boys are trained, they're brahmacharis, and they're trained in the grihastha ashram. They're trained to become grihasthas. Isn't that interesting? So I asked Bhakti Vidyaparnaswami, he said, why? Why would you train brahmacharis in the brahmachari ashram to be grihasthas? He said, because in brahmachari ashram, you learn everything in life. You have to learn everything for your future. It's a different paradigm. You know, no ISKCON temple trains their men to be grihasthas, and our men make some of the worst husbands in three worlds, isn't it? Because they were trained to be brahmacharis, so they get married and they're brahmacharis, and they're not good husbands. And then I said, but that's very controversial, because you know, you should be training brahmacharis to be brahmacharis. He said, when you train them to be married, if they're brahmacharis, they realize that they want to get married. Because now they understand what it's like more clearly. And the ones who want to get married are trained. That's a paradigm shift. Go try to convince the temple to do that. They'll think you're nutty. But it's the best thing you could do.
I think with that old Vedic culture, that's what it was. The brahmachari was supposed to be trained to be a good brahmacharya. Then they can choose whether they can be a brahmacharya or they can go to a grihastha ashram. Because unless they are trained in grihastha ashram...
We train our brahmacharis to hate marriage. That's why we have so much trouble in the grihastha ashram. But my point is, this is just an example of a paradigm shift. And if you look at the problem, you say, these are problems A, B, C, D. What can we do as a community to resolve these? Because if you don't, they're just going to continue. They're going to fester. And then the cracks are going to get bigger. And one day, the building's going to crush. I think. I don't know. I mean, Krishna's maintaining it. I can't say it's going to crack. But where ISKCON is today, it has not caught up to where it was when Prabhupada left. It has not caught up in any way. You go back to temples, you go, this temple's really nice, things are going on. If you were there in 1976, it's about a third of what it was then.
But if you look at the number of centers they open,
yeah,
they've been almost 400 centers open.
Yeah, that's mostly due to India, isn't it?
I don't know.
India or Russia. It's mostly due to, but let's analyze it. It's mostly due to India, Russia, and maybe China. But the rest of the world?
Mm-mm. Then in my opinion, there are lessons to be learned. In America, it started up first. And what happened to America? Hope it doesn't happen the same thing in new centers coming up.
If we don't learn
from America,
yeah,
we are going to have the same mistake in Russia and other growing world.
You know, but this is a really good point. ISKCON's expanded, but that's just a broad statement. And I think my statement is accurate. India, Russia, maybe China. Nowhere else. Everywhere else, it's nothing what it was.
So that's where we learn the lesson from North America and apply in those developing places, so that we don't have the same problem 20 years down the road in those temples.
I think if you do this, you'll have an amazing temple. I think about these things a lot, and my conclusion is that many things have to change, and they can change, and they can be really good, and you can be exemplary. And all the naysayers and people who poo-poo you, they'll come here 10 years down the road and say, show me what you did. That's the way ISKCON has always been. Anything that succeeds, everyone knocks on your door. Can you show us? You'll be there at ILS. You know, this is what we did. This is what it was. This is what we did. If you say it now, they'll go, you can't do that. That's not right. You have to do it.
But it is being a leader. That's what you're saying.
I think it's exciting because it's such a different dynamic than it was 20, 30 years ago, and we're not adapting well. So, you know. How many of you and Manus are there in Vancouver? If there were more, they'd be here, right? People who are retired or semi-retired, who somehow can manage financially and give all this time, right? It's not practical. If you rely on that, you don't have anything. If you can figure out how to generate enough money where you can get some super intelligent guy to help you manage the temple so you can do the real things you need to do and not run around, wow, wouldn't that be good? And how many of those guys are out there? A lot. But you guys? I don't know if there are any more out there. That's the problem I see, you know? We're like, this is a huge, in my mind, it's a huge problem. Right? And then how many Aniruddhas out there are there who will give 20% of their energy to the temple instead of 100% because of the way the temple is? So when you make the temple better, then it gets 100%. Yes? Yeah. So, you know, these are realities that you need to talk about. Right? What's the future of the Brahmacharya Ashram here? Is there a future? Do we want one? Do we not? What do we have to do? Why does it exist? All these discussions are there, and you're smart, you'll come up with ideas.
We don't on a geographical level, like, there could be one center teaching, just like Mahaprabhu, teaching all Brahmacharya, and they can be supported all over the world,
exactly.
Because they're churning in numbers, and we cannot accommodate that.
Yeah,
there could be something in North America like that.
Yeah.
Some could be, just like government does, there's a specific center for one special in one town, other town has another specific center for something special.
I think that was once the idea, maybe Kansas City with the Bhakta program there, and you know, Dhanavir Maharaj, and send them there, they got trained in book distribution, and then they come back.
Yeah. Is it still training? I thought there was some problem.
Know.
I thought there was some problem because I brought that up, that there was some problem.
Yeah, maybe. Well, that was the idea.
Yeah. Do you know what's happening in language?
Yeah. Successful TSKP.
Yeah. Yeah, they're doing book distribution. Yeah, big. Some devotees are sending their devotees to Germany. Anyway, did we make any progress, or am I?
Said brainstorming.
Am I agitating you by talking? Or I don't know.
Agitating is good enough.
Yeah,
brainstorming. We all brainstorm.
I'm very concerned because I see. Okay, before you say anything, this might sum it up. I don't see lack of qualification in ISKCON.
Agreed.
I see lack of discussion. I see lack of cohesive teams. I see lack of changing strategies to accommodate the problems, and therefore the problems keep going, and everybody just complains, well, this is what it's like, and we can't do anything. That's what I see. And that concerns me a lot. And then I study companies like Google and these other companies that have these like amazing dynamics and cultures. And it frustrates me that I attend this seminar by Avatar and they're getting along. All of the leaders are really cohesive and they're kind of like egoless. And it bothers me that, because that's what we're supposed to be doing. Like you say, it's already there in our philosophy.
The culture practice.
Yeah. So I think that's my concern. That we have, Prabhupada gave it to us and we don't do it, and then we run into problems. And people get discouraged and they don't want to participate. And we lose people. We lost so many people. If you keep losing them, how can you have a movement?
Yeah.
Bring them in, lose it. Bring them in, lose it.
Just like if you look at that, this example is better to retain a customer rather than to find a new customer.
Yeah.
And what we are doing finding a new customer all the time and losing all our old customers.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what training is from basically, even here.
Yeah. Another problem. Then, what about, you know, you ever read any of these mission statements of these really high-end companies, really successful, who are totally focused on customer service? You know, that's their whole meditation, how to create an incredible experience for the customer. But what if we did that for people? That would mean from the time they come to the time they leave their body, you're with them the whole day. How to do that, you know, that's important. But I think if you're thinking like this, it becomes so exciting that people outside in your congregation, when they hear about it, they're going to want to help. Say, I like this idea, I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or when they give you an idea, a good manager says, can you do it? I like your idea, can you do it? Can I help you do it? Yes?
The most important thing, at least in this temple or around the world, what we are facing is how to run the temple, no finances.
Yeah.
That is the main thing I'm noticing, that they're not able to think of anything else. everybody yeah. how to bring along, yeah. how to do, how to, these are the energy that's going.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm putting forward to the management here saying that
yes.
I want some self-sufficiency in running
yeah.
the
yeah.
temple.
Right.
That's why I'm going, I have the idea of having a banquet hall, a restaurant,
yeah. Yeah.
and improve this agricultural land. We have many things, so
yeah.
but the, still we are struggling how to survive, that is taking
yeah.
put forward everything slowly.
Well, probably because the energy hasn't been put there enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Just starting on to that one, I'm seeing that.
And my big thing is we have to be professional educators where people will pay to hear us, listen to us. Workshops, retreats, that also is another dimension. Making money by preaching. That's fantastic. I'm totally supportive.
Also, if we create a culture that supports, maintains, grows our devotee community, then
yeah.
we have more income.
Yeah, exactly.
More people that are interested in being at the temple.
There's also another paradigm, and I don't know if this works everywhere you can think about it, but another paradigm is to lease. If, let's say you want to develop projects, but you can't do it all yourself, either financially or resource-wise, so you lease it out to an individual and say, you run this, you give the temple profit split. Now the devotee is making a living doing service. You know, I mean, if that would work in a situation where you could expand it very widely, where you could have lots of devotees. Like in one temple, the gift shop, it was run privately, and it was run better because it was her business. And then she rented the space and gave, I don't know, they had a percentage, you know, or maybe even the restaurant was run that way. So that's another option, a way of engaging people. So now you might have 20 people engaged making a living, but they're bringing people in. And as they bring people in, one thing leads to the next. They come to the restaurant, then there's the banquet hall. And there's anyway, it's a different paradigm. It's something, you know, you can consider. Yes?
Well, on that note, in terms of outside agencies helping out with this con, I think there will be always the thought by some devotees that why are these Mayavadis doing this and, you know, involving them in some sort of temple relationship. I'm just wondering if you have thoughts to
it. So, for example, people, what, helping us doing a festival or something?
Mm-hmm. Or like a business and contributing, like the gift shop, as you were saying, or restaurant.
Yeah, you'd have to discuss who would be doing it, if it would be devotees or. I had a wild idea. You want to hear it?
Yes, okay.
One of the fastest growing businesses, at least in India and maybe here, is old age homes. Of course, nobody takes care of their parents. And I thought, my wild idea was have an old age home next to every temple.
We were talking about 4 years ago?
We are presenting in the Canadian leaders meeting
yeah.
now. They're going there myself, we are proposing that one.
I thought, you know, I had different ideas. You know, but in one model is, let's say Anirudha says, okay, I'll do it. I'll build the building. You know, we have the 99-year lease or whatever. And then I'll give you 15% and, you know, whatever, you know, could do it that way. Or you could build a building, you could lease it to him, or of course you could do it yourself. But in my vision, I had this vision of like you'd have 30, 40, 50 businesses and it was all leased out, but the temple is like now this amazing community, which you could never manifest from your own people. And now you have 30 devotees here working, you know, full time. Anyway. I think these kinds of ideas are...
Talking about this since 2010, when we bought the house, the idea of one house and that.
Old age home and a hospice. I think an old age home managed by devotees, wow, it's the best of everything.
Talking since 2010, so when we bought the house, this was whole talk about that you can turn it out to a daycare or a senior care, but we couldn't do it. 5 years,
one and a half. No, when I, Mother Pagal, this one, we're planning to make
yeah.
it old age.
No, we're going this 5 years, yeah.
Rules and regulations.
Anyway, you can have so many things. Krishna conscious daycare.
Hospice also, nobody list of things.
shopping mall. In case I had another, you know, KC shopping mall, all stores, devotee-owned stores.
Just like the biggest store, that's what the CS do. They have a photo shop which is leased by somebody else.
Yeah.
They have some travel shop which is leased by somebody else. That's what they end up, but it's all looks under, under CS.
Yeah.
But they're taking money from them. Same concept.
I have a friend who's a very good businessman, and he said he felt that you need some people with business brains to come here and say, here it is, how can we turn this into, you know, an income? This is what we need to run this project. How can we use this property of land to generate that?
That's a great idea. Maybe some business students from BCIT or some of the universities or something like that, give them a project to help with. Get their brains working, they have to get grades on it anyways.
We had that once in San Diego. Students, they were doing a course in marketing, and they were thinking that their assignment was to help us market. That was fun. They had to come up with all these ideas to market. Anyway.
The ideas may come, every time comes is who would give the capital, from where to get the capital. That's the main thing, isn't it? So that's what I'm working on, who will be paying, who will be doing.
But don't you think when you have the right idea that and the right team and everybody's together, that at that point Krishna will say, okay, you guys get along, you got the right idea, I'll give the money at that point. And
that's
I'm not going to give it until you... That's what I feel. I feel like
2013 is the same thing. Half $1 million project. I don't know how it started, how it ended also. It's a wonderful thing. You're right.
But I think the key is you guys. You know, you're... As confirmed in this book, you know, your social skills and getting along and working together are everything. And
yeah.
As a leader, if you create that...
Yeah.
Then it'll all come. And there's another, I'll tell you another story, which is very inspiring to me. A man called a group of people together to meet to discuss how we could get rid of the penal system in America, all the jails and prisons. And everybody said, you can't do that. And he said, that doesn't matter. We're not talking practical. I just want to discuss, you know, theoretically. So everybody understood, okay, it's theoretical, we're not talking practical. And as a result of that conversation, they came up with numerous ways to prevent crime. And that was their solution to the penal system. You know, they could, how are you going to get rid of the penal system? You have to get rid of crime. So they came up with these amazing ideas that they never would have come up with if they had to make the discussion practical. So I think that's also important, you know, to... Theoretically, you know, look and plan and say, okay, this is what we want. And then from there, then start thinking, okay. But if you can get people inspired by your vision, if it's so inspiring.
That's what we did multi-purpose on. That's what our idea was. That we were meeting last year, we put all the things what we need, boss space, senior care, daycare, everything is put on the list.
Yes,
well, anyway, something to think about.
Yeah, we already thought about it.
Maybe revive it.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have lunch time.
Put all the list what we need. Baby,
we are having
hospice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hospice and everything. Because that is my
best. I thought about it. We need something like snacks or tea, whatever, those things.
We can take the all the things in the air.
Drop it in the floor.
The community living and then the hospice also. We need the hospice. We need to put 3 beds in the hospice. We can't put that far.
Eventually. But if you also use the paradigm of letting someone else run it.
We're just thinking of the we just throw out the ideas.
Yeah.
Then we just go priority wise what the priority is.
Think of the idea of just, I don't know if it's a good idea, but Krishna sent me the idea because I conceived that this whole community completely run as independent businesses who are leasing from the temple and giving a percentage of their profit. And this huge community is running and the temple president doesn't have to manage. He just has to make sure they follow certain principles, like at a mall.
Yeah.
You have to open at 10, close at
yeah.
6, you know. It's an interesting idea because that gets everybody out of their job
yeah.
and now they're here at the temple and they can come to the morning program because they don't have to be, right?
I think similar thing in Alaska, isn't it? Alachua, I don't know much about Alachua.
There's a few there where he's working full time, getting paid. Their budget is about $15,000 a month for salaries. You know, India budgets are used. They hire so many people.
Yeah, India is different. They need a lot of cash.
One of my goals in life is to get devotees to quit their jobs and be able to support themselves within a ISKCON community and living.
That's what we learned, the social aspect of ISKCON. So far, we've been going on what we call a growth. When Srila Prabhupada comes to the growth phase, if you look at any corporation, they go to the growth phase, then a maturity phase, and then maintenance, and they dwindle down. Just like every corporation does it. So how to maintain that? Because in the growth phase, growth is then you have to maintain that growth. And then maturity comes, then you plateau down there.
Inspiration is very important.
In any aspect of life. If you're not inspired to do your job, no one will do it.